I moved to Los Angeles, California, Hollywood to be exact, in February of 1991. All my life, I'd lived in Northern California, San Jose, Santa Cruz. And basically right around 1991, my first band, Frontline, decided to kick me out of the band. And the best thing about it was, the way they kicked me out of the band was, you know, I really didn't pick up on any of the, basically, you know, when you're in a band and you kind of get the vibe that it ain't happening between you and the other people. And, you know, there's that conversation of, you know, it's not working out and we're thinking maybe, you know, we're going to do our thing and you do your thing. But when you're the singer in the band, you're, you know, you're the guy that's in charge of everything. You're the guy booking the gigs, or at least in my band, in any band I've ever been in, I've been that guy. So while I was in Frontline, they decided they couldn't finally get it through my thick head that I was no longer going to be in the band. So they moved all of the gear out of the rehearsal spot that we used to practice in. And I came in there thinking that we were going to practice. All the gear's gone except my mic stand and PA. And I literally called up our guitar player, Mr. Bill Franza. And I said, dude, all our gear's been stolen. And he's like, dude, the gear wasn't stolen. You're out of the band. So that's how I had to basically find out that I was no longer the lead front man for the band Frontline. At that point, decided, you know what? Had enough of San Jose. And I think San Jose had had enough of me. And I decided to move to Los Angeles. I moved in with a buddy of mine, Brian Turcotte. At that point, he was living in Hollywood right off of Wilshire Boulevard. And he said, look, man, nothing's going on for you in San Jose. And you can come and live with me. But the deal is this. You can live here for a month. I'll give you 4 weeks in my apartment. But if you can't get your shit together in 4 weeks, it ain't going to happen. And you got to move on. I was like, all right, I'm into it. I remember I came down. It was in February. I came down on a Saturday night. And I remember as I pulled in to Hollywood, it was, you know, I'd been down here playing shows and stuff. But, you know, now at this point, I'm moving here. Like, I'm getting off the 101 right there at Highland. Not to, you know, go to a show at the Whiskey or head on over to the Roxy. Like, now I am moving here. And I have everything, all of my worldly possessions with me, which at that point consisted of, I think, a 1982 Ford Escort that was burgundy, with the right passenger window totally blown out for like a year, piece of cardboard over it, a black leather jacket, a skateboard, of course, a boombox, a sleeping bag, and probably like 3 or 4 shirts, a pair of Levi's, some Converse, maybe a pair of Creepers, and that was it. So I pull into his place, and I'll never forget, I show up at Brian Ray's place, and he had a full-on apartment. Like, he was my age, but he was already a man. He had an apartment with furniture. Like, I'm not talking a crash pad. Like, furniture that matched. He had a real stereo. He had artwork on the walls. He had, like, dishes and glasses and forks and knives that all matched. He didn't live with, like, 30 dudes. He lived with one roommate. And on top of all of this, he was going out with a woman. Not a chick. Not some girl. He was going on with a full-on older woman. Like, she had to have been, and in my eyes, she was like old. She was 30 years old. We were all 23. She was a 30-year-old lady going out with Brian. And I was just like, damn, this guy is on fire. And then on top of it all, he worked at Slash Records. At that point, Slash, of course, being home to, you know, L7. They did all Los Lobos stuff. And then all the early punk rock stuff, X, you know, the decline of the Western civilization, all that stuff. So I was just like, man, Brian Ray is so fucking rad. And I am so lame. And immediately, I had to find a gig really, really quick. And I ended up getting a job at a place called Ellis Prop House. And I worked there, got my stuff together, got my shit together, ended up moving out of Brian Ray's house. And at that point, I was working at Ellis, putting away props. The deal was these trucks would come in with like a million, you know, props on there. Like, hey, this is a lamp that we used in the commercial. This is a saddle because it was a Western commercial. This is the jacket that we used. My gig was to take all of that junk or all of those props out of that truck and then put them into this prop house. And that was my first gig in Hollywood. And it made it possible for me to get my first apartment. It made it possible for me to, you know, basically get out of Brian Ray's apartment, which at this point I still would like to live with Brian Ray. But at that point I'm working like, you know, 10 hours a day. And I remember across the street from my first apartment lived a guy named Burko. Had long hair. He was a singer in a band. I'd ran, you know, into him a few times when I was coming down with my old band Frontline. But Burko and I became friends. He was my, you know, neighbor across the street. He'd go for jogs because he was like a rock singer. Really, really cool guy. And he was in a band called She Died. And I remember he would, you know, come out and him and I would kind of shoot the shit in front of my house or my apartment. And one time he said to me, he said, "Hey, where are you working at?" And I'm like, "Ah, man, I work at this place, Ellis." He's like, "Really? Why?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, it's the only gig I've got." And he's like, "How many hours are you working there?" And I'm like, "I don't know, between, you know, 8 to 10. He's like, "Dude, I'm telling you right now, dude, you're in Hollywood now. You need a rock and roll job." And I'm like, "A rock and roll job? Like moving gear? Like, what do you mean a rock and roll job?" He's like, "Dude, I work up at this place called Duke's on Sunset. It's directly connected to the whiskey. It's still there too." I said, "All right." And he goes, "Come up tomorrow. I'm going to introduce you to the boss. I'm going to tell you right now, her name's Henny. She's completely out of control. She'll yell at you. She'll scream at you. But here's the deal. You can deliver food for Duke's and you'll make as much or more money than you're making right now at Ellis. And you ready for this? You will only work 3 hours a day." I was like, "Dude, I'm in. I am totally down for that." So I go up there. I take the interview with this lady named Henny. She's just like, "Why do you want to work here? What are you doing? Are you in a band? Bop, 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 bop." I'm like, I just say yes, no, yes, whatever it took to get this gig. I end up getting the gig. I bail Ellis Mercantile, and I have a rock and roll job at this point. And it is awesome because basically I'm going into work at 10 when my roommate used to still work at Ellis. He's rolling in there at 8 in the morning, getting up at 7. I'm rolling in 2, 3 in the morning because I don't got to be work till 10 a.m. I'm still making rent, and I'm off work every day between 1 and 2, and they gave me a meal. That was a rock and roll job, but it gets better. Everyone would eat at Duke's. Every single band that would come through in the early 90s would stop by Duke's. Skid Row, they came in there. "Hey, man, what's up?" I give them food. They were cool. You know, I mean, I wasn't a Skid Row fan, but Sebastian was cool. I remember Metallica came in there right after they were on the MTV Music Awards, and I was like, "No way, Metallica in here. That's pretty rad." I was like, "Yeah." And my job was when everyone came into the restaurant, I'd run down to the front of the restaurant with the menus. "Hi, how many in your party? Cool. You know, would you like to sit by the window? Would you like orange juice?" That was always the thing. "Would you like some orange juice?" So I remember one time I'm sitting in there and it's like, you know, 12 in the afternoon, probably right before lunch or maybe right even after the lunch rush. And I never really got starstruck by anybody that came in there because, you know, a lot of those bands just weren't the bands I was into. I mean, hey, Metallica's cool, but they weren't like my life. You know, obviously Skid Row wasn't my life. But this one afternoon, I see this these about 4 people come to the door and they're kind of, you know, waiting for me to come down with the menus. And they have 2 little kids with them. And there's like an older woman, an older lady, kind of grandma and grandpa vibe. And then this younger couple with them. And I come down there. And as I walk down there with my menus, I look up and all of a sudden I am face to face with Joe Strummer. And I'm like, "No fucking way." And it wasn't like, "Is that Joe Strummer?" It was like, I knew it was Joe Strummer right when I saw him. Slick back hair. He had like a cool button-up Hawaiian on, you know, a pair of baggies on, some black Docs. And I was just like, "No fucking way, Joe Strummer." And I just stared at him. And he looked at me and I looked at him and I couldn't get a word out of my mouth. I just was staring at him like, "There you are, right in front of me." I mean, I've seen Rude Boy way too many times. I've stared at every record you've ever been on. And right now you're face to face with me and I can't even get the words out how many are in your party. And I remember finally he kind of like took the menus out of my hand and it shook me out of my stupor that I was in. And I was like, "Oh yeah. How many in your party?" And he's like, "Oh mate, we, you know, we've got 6 of us here." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, yeah, sure, here, let me take you over there." And I take him over and I seat him in some table and I just come back and that woman, Henny's like, "You didn't ask him if they wanted orange juice." And I'm like, "Henny, not now. You don't even know who that is." And she's like, "I don't care who it is. Ask him if they want orange juice. And why are you so excited?" I'm like, "Henny, that is Joe Strummer from The Clash. Like, that band is the reason I even live in Hollywood. You don't even get it. The Clash, first record. Give him enough rope. I mean, the Sandinista, I mean, you don't even understand that that's the guy right there." And she's just like, "All right, whatever." So I walk over, "Hey, you know, would you guys like some orange juice?" And I, you know, get him some orange juice. I come back to the cash register. And at that point, he must have thought like either I was like stalking him or, you know, I just was a complete you know, in oblivion of just like, this is Joe Strummer. And I was just staring at him. I just sat at the cash register and I was staring at him the whole time he was sitting there. And I remember at one point he walked down to this area that we had all like these papers and crayons for like little kids to draw on. And he was getting some stuff for his kids. Cause you know, at that point he's not Joe Strummer going out to sing White Ride. He's Joe Strummer with his two kids and he's got to entertain them. So he goes down there and I just go, you know what? F it. I'm going to walk down there. If I don't introduce myself to this guy, I will regret it for the rest of my life. And I just walk down there and he's grabbing some papers and some crayons. And I go, Mr. Strummer, I don't want to bother you, but if I don't say hello to you and introduce myself, I will regret it for the rest of my life. My name's Joe Sib. I moved here to Hollywood about 6 months ago. And if it wasn't for The Clash, I wouldn't be into music, punk rock, or anything in my life. I just have to thank you for that. And I remember he looked at me and he goes, hey, Joe Sib, I'm Joe. And I'm like, yeah. And he's just like, what's up? And we just start talking. And we're sitting there and I'm asking him, you know, what are you doing here? And he's telling me, oh, I'm out here on holiday. And I'm like, great, man. You know, so English, holiday, you know. And I'm sitting there and we're kind of shooting the shit. And there was this poster that was one of those like rock posters of like supposedly what's going on in heaven. You know, Janis Joplin, Bon Scott, you know, Sid Vicious, you know, all of those, like, it's like a caricature of everyone having like a meal or like hanging out in Hollywood, you know, hanging out in heaven. And I remember he kind of glanced up and looked at it and he looked at the part of Sid. And I remember he looks at Sid and he goes, ah, yeah, Sid, he was a good guy. I liked Sid. And like right then I'm like, man, I'm face to face with Joe Strummer. And he just told me that he was friends with Sid Vicious. I'm like, man, my life is complete at this point. All right, he goes back, they eat their meal. While he's eating his meal, I run across the street, and this is when they had Tower Records on Sunset Boulevard. And I run down there, I grab a copy on vinyl of Give Him Enough Rope. I come back, and I just stash it behind the cash register, so when he comes up to pay his bill, I'm just going to bother him one last time and just ask him to sign my album. Of course, he comes up, he's totally cool, he pays his bill. I go, hey man, Joe, would you mind signing this for me? It would mean so much to me. And he even went one step further. He signed the record, and then he took out one of the papers that his daughters had, you know, been ready to draw on, and he drew this whole Clash. Basically, it was like to Joe, from Joe, and he drew the star with the Clash written behind it. And I mean, it was like, it was, you know, I still have it. It was like 8x10 artwork from Joe Strummer to me. And I mean, it was one of those things that, like, that night I couldn't even go to bed. You know, I was just like, I just kept staring at the picture that he drew. I kept listening to the record that he signed. And I was like, man, this, I mean, who would have thought that this would have happened? I am so stoked I moved to Hollywood. Well, about a week later, it was my birthday. And I was 23 and I was turning 24 years old. And I remember Fugazi was in town. They were playing the Palladium. And me and a bunch of our friends all went to the show. We were like, yes, Fugazi, Joe Sib's birthday, let's go. So we go to the show. We have a blast. Fugazi rips. I remember as we're leaving the Palladium, just randomly, I look down, $100 bill in front of us. Now, this part of the story is maybe not politically correct or maybe not, I don't know, complete with going to see a Fugazi show. But, you know, I drink and all my friends drink. So immediately when we found the $100 bill, I'm like, dude, first round is on me. Let's go. At that point, it was like $100. I'm like, every round is on me. Because back then, $100, it's the same as like if I would have found $1,000. So I get this $100 bill. We go down to the bar and we go to this local bar. Back then, it was on Melrose Avenue, and it was called Smalls. Everyone would hang out there, and it was literally like this little teeny bar, you know, little small place. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, uncommon to see, like, the Chili Peppers in there or Soundgarden or, you know, you'd run across any band. Anybody that was in town that was recording or doing anything, it was so centralized, and it was cool. They had a killer DJ that would play, you know, everything that you dug. So, you know, it was a good place to go and drink, and it was all musicians hanging out, and it was just a good vibe. So I go in there. It's my birthday. I throw down the $100 bill, and I'm like, it is on, man. Until this thing runs out, keep the drinks coming. There's shots being thrown around. Beers are being thrown around. Everyone's just having a blast. And at this point, I was in my new band, Wax, and all of these guys were with me. So we're all sitting there together, and we're all hanging out together, and everyone's just drinking. We're having a blast. And suddenly, I kind of hear someone talking in the background, and they say, you know, like, shh, dude, Joe Strummer. And I'm like, that guy just said Joe Strummer. And then I kind of, like, you know, listen to the conversation. The guy's like, dude, Joe Strummer, look, he's over there in the back booth. No way, Joe. And I'm like, no way. Joe Strummer's here? And, you know, and I'm kind of buzzed, you know, and I'm like, I just saw Fugazi and I found $100. I'm like, I wonder if Joe Strummer will remember me, man. Like, I wonder, like, if I kind of pop my head over there, if he'll remember who I am. So I kind of stagger through the crowd, and I go over to this booth, one of those big leather booths, and sitting right in the middle of it is Joe Strummer, man. He's, like, you know, right in the center of it. He's got two people to the left, a couple people to the right, and he is just holding court. He's right in the midst of a story, and he's got a drink in front of him. And at this point, it's the Joe Strummer. It's not the Joe Strummer at Duke's with the kids and the wife and the grandparents. This is Joe Strummer of The Clash holding court in Hollywood, California. And I'm like, yes. And I pop my head in, and I remember it took all of about half of a second, and we caught eye contact, and he looks at me, and he goes, "Joseph from Duke's." And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Get over here." And I go, "No way." Immediately, he talked to some like handler, like he had some guy with him. And he like whispers something to the guy. That guy just gets everyone in the booth to bail. And now I'm sitting next to Strummer. Like I just get right there on the big leather, you know, booth. And I sit down next to him. He says, "How you doing, man?" And I go, "Great. How are you?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm having a great night." He goes, "Hey, anyone from your band here?" And I go, "Yeah." I go, "They're all here." He goes, "Get them over here." So all of a sudden, I look at Loomis, our drummer. I go, "Dude, go get Birdie, go get Soda." So we grab them. They all come over. Now we're sitting in the booth, the four of us, with Joe Strummer. So it's everyone in Wax and Joe Strummer, and now he is holding court with us. And I remember I'm just like, no friggin' way. It's my birthday. I just saw Fugazi, and now I'm hanging out with Joe Strummer at Smalls. I mean, dude, this is it. Like, if I die right now, done. Stoked. We sit there, and I ask Joe, I go, "Man, you know, I don't want to bother you, Joe, but there's just so many questions that I have about The Clash." And I remember our bass player, Birdie, you know, huge fan of The Clash too. He had a ton of questions. And he goes, "Ask me anything you want. That's why we did it. We were a band for 5 years, and that's why we did it. Ask me anything that you want." And I remember we sat in that booth. And I don't drink hard alcohol. I'm like a beer guy. You know, I drink a shot or two. You know, I could drink beer I can drink like 40 beers and be fine. But like, if I start drinking tequila or I start drinking like Jameson or any of that stuff, I'll seriously, my face starts drooping. I just get ripped. But that night, Strummer was drinking tequila straight. And he asked us at one point while we're asking him these Clash questions, what are you guys drinking? I'm like, "I'm drinking what you're drinking." "Yeah, well, I'm drinking tequila." "Yeah, that's what I drink, Joe, because I'm hanging out with you." And I remember shots came over, beers come over, and we just started asking him every question. "All right, let's talk about the first record. Is it true that you guys really recorded in 2 weeks?" "Yes, it is, and let me tell you why." Da-da-da-da-da, goes through that. "Talk to me about Sandinista, man. The record, it was huge. There was so much of it. You know what? We couldn't stop writing." Talks about that. Talked about touring. Talked about when he went disappeared. Talked about everything about being in the band. And I remember he looked at all of us, and his main thing that he had to convey to all of us that night was basically, "You know what? Have fun with it. Don't take it so seriously, and have fun with it." And I remember that night just sitting there, and I can still see his face and just like how cool he was, and how so many other bands that, you know, just aren't even like a quarter of as inspiring and as influential as The Clash are. You know, you run into these guys that, you know, sold a few records, and they have an attitude that like they're Joe Strummer and they're a prick. And here he is, Joe Strummer, the guy that's like basically inspired all of us. I mean, everyone in that bar could be like, "Yeah, dude, if it wasn't for The Clash, yeah, exactly, I wouldn't be here either." I mean, the whole bar could have, you know, Church of Joe Strummer at that point. And literally, this guy was just so frigging cool to us and so real. And I remember at that point, you know, at the end of the night, we stayed with him till the end. You know, last call, like lights go on. And I remember we walked out of the bar, and I'm not making this up, and I know I stretch the truth sometime, but I swear to you, me and Joe Strummer on my 24th birthday walked out of Smalls arm in arm. And he said, "Hey, I'm going to be back in a few weeks with the Pogues. Shane can't get into the country. I'm going to sing for him." I was like, really cool. At that point, I was like, dude, I never even need to hang out with you ever again, because this night was so great, I would never want to mess it up. And I remember as we walked out in the street, Strummer went one way and we all went the other way. And I looked back and he looked at me and we both just waved to each other. And at that point, I just turned 24 years old, saw Fugazi, found $100, drank all night with Joe Strummer. And that night I went to bed going, man, 24 is looking pretty good.